Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Lucy Pony in Washington.
And I'm Michael Atit, also in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, February 24th, 2015. The South Sudan peace talks in Ethiopia capital slowly get off the ground.
The discussion today was well, and the two warring party plus other stakeholders, they were in good spirit of discussion. We agree on a lot of things.
And a new political party is formed in Juba.
PLP intend to create a liberal, transparent political environment where people will prosper politically, economically, and socially.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A group of young South Sudanese intellectuals have formed a new political party. The party leaders say they will introduce political and economic reforms that will reduce the country's future. Worker Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
The People's Liberal Party of South Sudan, or PLP, was launched over the weekend under the theme Creating Liberal Transparent Society for Future Generations. About 20 people attended the event. The party's leaders, most of whom are under the age of 40, have backgrounds in law, economics, and mass communication. 37-year-old Peter Mayen Majongdit is PLP's interim leader. Majongdit is a civil society activist with a master's in mass communication who hails from Warab State, the same as President Salva Kiir, the head of the ruling SPLM party.
PLP intend to create a liberal, transparent political environment where people will prosper politically, economically, and socially.
Other South Sudanese opposition parties have been demanding reforms in the Kiir administration for some time now. Several have accused President Salva Kiir and his cabinet of corruption, lack of transparency and accountability, along with the causing widespread insecurity. Majongdit acknowledges the road ahead won't be easy for the PLP, but he says the new party will strive to make peaceful reforms in South Sudan.
The political forces in this country, they need to have a transparent and accountable system, which each and everybody will be held accountable, be it to issues related to finance, be it to issues related to violations of human rights, citizen rights.
Majongdit says PLP plans to foster security and a vibrant economy. He says his party's economic priority is to chart South Sudan on a new course which is far less dependent on oil.
The only revenue that we are milking from today is the oil. But as a matter of fact, even at this stage, we don't need the oil. The reasons are very simple. Why do we don't need the oil? We have huge and other massive revenues that we can capitalize and generate an income from.
Approximately 98% of South Sudan's revenue is generated from oil. Dr. Isaac Deng of Lake State, who holds a PhD in engineering, is the Secretary General of the PLP. He says PLP intends to reform the economic policies of the country by strengthening its economic independence.
We are not going to sit down begging humanitarian organizations and foreign countries always to donate and to do and to to help. We are a country that have a lot of resources. What we lack is just a clear plan, a strategic one, and the objective.
Zakaria Ding Akol is a researcher and analyst with the Sud Institute, a Juba-based think tank. He says PLP's launch is another indication that competitive politics may have a place in the country's future, but it's not going to solve the nation's problems.
We have political parties already, so there's nothing new. Our problem is not lack of political parties. Our problem is the credibility of the political parties. So to what extent would this new political party is going to be any different from the ones we have?
PLP is the latest political party to be launched in South Sudan since the country gained its independence in 2011. For VOA News, I am Waka Simon Wudu in Juba.
The The South Sudan peace talks went into their second day today in Addis Ababa. Delegates from the two sides discussed issues of governance, how to fight corruption, the future of the country's economy, and how to reunify the SPLM party. The SPLM split into factions when the country erupted in violence 14 months ago. Last month, members of the different factions agreed at talks in Arusha, Tanzania, on a reunification proposal. But in Addis Ababa, the committee tasked with discussing the Arusha deal failed to agree on how to use it as the basis for a broader power-sharing agreement to take South Sudan forward to peace. Government spokesman Michael Makwe blames Riek Machar's rebel group for the setback, but he says he is hopeful the two sides will reach a peace deal in Addis by March 5th deadline set by the regional bloc IGAD.
Despite the reneging by the rebels on the Arusha peace talks, nevertheless, we are optimistic. Peace is coming. Peace is around the corner. We should be hopeful.
A church leader at the talks says the two parties have no other option but to find lasting peace. Isaiah Majok Dow says the Arusha reunification agreement and the talks being held in Addis are very important steps to resolving the conflict.
SPLM leaders disagreed on basically on two things. One, they disagreed on whether the Arusha agreement addresses the issue of power sharing. And two, whether it is complementary to Addis process. In our view, these two issues are related.
There was some progress made at the talks. The committee discussing finances agreed to move forward with issues to do with the country's economy during the transitional period. Agre Idris is the Deputy Secretary for Finance and Economic Affairs for Machar's SPLM in opposition and represented the rebel group on the finance committee.
We are talking about institutions that will correct and improve the economy of the country. You have institutions such as Anti-Corruption Commission. You have institutions to be created like Revenue Authority, institutions like Salaries and Remuneration Commission, because we don't have a unified salary and a better salary, which need our salary need to be done. We are talking about even improving the minimum wage for people in the Republic.
But he says the committee has not agreed on how to share South Sudan's wealth.
The constitution talks of the wealth of the nation will be shared equitably among various levels of government. That is Article 37. But Article 38, instead of addressing how this equitable distribution will be done, went silent. So this is an area we have not agreed with the government, and it is referred to the leadership. And the other area is the national debts of the country. What is the total debt? Because total debt is very important for the budgetary process during the transitional period, because it impacts. You must be repaying your debts.
Meanwhile, the Committee on Security also failed to agree on a key issue, how to address security issues during the transitional period. But Emmanuel Paul, who is representing civil society groups on the Security Committee, says the committee did not make some progress, particularly on the issue of foreign forces in South Sudan.
We agree on disengagement of separation of and withdrawal of the forces, including the allied forces. And the allied forces are known. There is forces from our regions that are involved into our crisis, and I cannot mention them. And also we agree of assembling and contents of forces, provisions, combat, and those issues will be discussed tomorrow.
The committee will continue their discussions tomorrow. That report was prepared by John Tanza, who is in Addis Ababa for the talks. Regional bloc IGAD has said this round of talks is the last chance to restore peace in South Sudan.
And now back to Juba, ahead of the collision Sunday afternoon between a passenger's bus traveling from Kampala and taxi on a Juba-Nimuli roadway left one person dead and 11 others seriously injured. Mugume David Zwakarinj went to Juba Teaching Hospital to talk to witness, survivors, police and medical personnel to find out what, if anything, is being done to curb South Sudan's frequent devastating traffic accidents.
With her legs wrapped in bandages, 34-year-old Elizabeth Jime groans while lying in her bed at Juba Teaching Hospital. her husband, Daniel Lokang, looks on helplessly. Not knowing whether his wife will ever walk again is bad enough. But Daniel Lokang says on top of that, he must contemplate the fate of the unborn child. Lokang says his wife is very ill. He says she's not able to talk, that all she can manage is a few words at a time. He says he worries that she will lose the unborn child she's carrying. His wife was critically injured when a speeding Bakul coach collided with a passenger car on Sunday afternoon along the Juba Nimre Road in Nisitu, some 30 kilometers south of Juba. 11 bus passengers and 3 pedestrians were injured. Elizabeth Jimmy was one of the pedestrians. Daniel Lokang, who is a soldier, had to abandon his official duties to attend to his wife. She sells green vegetables in nearby Serikat Market. Her meager earnings of about 20 to 30 pounds a day supports their family, including their 10, 8 and 6-year-old children who are now at home alone. Lokang says he cannot abandon her at the hospital in her condition. He says he is forced to leave his children at home alone, who have no one to feed them. Last month, another head-on collision between a passenger bus and a lorry occurred on the Juba Nimre Road near Aswa Bridge. 3 people were killed. 20 others were transported to the hospital. Not far from Sunday's accident, another accident occurred the following day, involving 2 border riders. One of the passengers was knocked off the motorbike and left unconscious. Police officers responded quickly to the border accident and rushed to transport the injured to Juba Teaching Hospital. Dr. Abraham Adut Abenego, Director for Accidents and Emergency Department, says such accidents are all too common.
Especially in the weekends, you expect a large number of patients to come in simply because most of them are involved in car accidents and some actually drunk.
He says sometimes they can receive as many as 80 patients involved in road accidents in one day, especially when commuter vehicles like buses from Kampala are involved. With a limited number of doctors at the hospital, Dr. Mnego says his staff can easily be overwhelmed by that kind of caseload.
Those who actually need immediate care, we put in category A and we just rush there with a good number of doctors. Those who are actually moderate and at least also they need to be attended to, we put them in category B. And those who actually are fit and they are conscious to say, you can put a category C, and we put a few number of doctors there to just oversee.
Dr. Beneko says road accidents often dominate the hospital resources, such as the medicine and equipment needed to treat accident victims. The biggest tragedy of all, he says, is that these types of accidents are totally preventable. Kanomande Enoka, South Sudan police spokesperson, agrees. He says police officials are very aware of the ongoing problem of excessive speed on roadways.
There are technical things which to be done, like, of course, to increase the number of signposts with proper, adequate warnings, which will be conspicuous, very clear that you can see on the road, and then plus the more deployment of the highway police on the road to actually regulate when there is a high speed, they intervene. And tend the people to adhere to the speed limit.
Hundreds of commuters have lost their lives along the Juba Nimre Road since it was opened in 2009. Police officials could not provide statistics on South Sudanese casualties due to the road accidents. It is not clear how many police officers will be deployed on Juba Nimre Highway to help control the flow and speed of traffic. But Kano Enoka says the number will be increased. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we are going to have a look at how to provide safe syringes in Africa. That is story after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today,
Do you grow your own food?
Actually, I'm growing on my own food. We are using rice and poshu. That's what is called two in Nigeria. We have pounded yam, like rice and beans.
Yeah, we grow just vegetables because we have a small piece of land that only feeds vegetables.
I used to, but not now. Since I came to Juba, where I stay is not good. The soil is not so that fertile, so I don't grow my own food. I used to buy.
Yes, we grow our own food. In our village, we have main crops, which is we have maize and sorghum. We do not have the modern crops like the tomatoes and onion and all that.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about safe syringes. The World Health Organization is launching a global campaign to stop the use of dirty syringes and needles that are responsible for millions of life-threatening infections each year. The new WHO initiative aims to prevent unsafe injections by promoting so-called smart syringes that cannot be used more than once. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the campaign's launch at WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Injections are supposed to cure illnesses and save lives, and in most cases they do. But the World Health Organization warns many of the 16 billion injections administered every year spread disabling, often deadly infections because of the reuse of contaminated syringes and needles. WHO reports around 10% of injections used for immunizations and procedures such as blood transfusions and injectable contraceptives are generally safe. The problems lie with the remaining 90% that inject medicine through the muscle or skin. WHO says a great many of these injections are not necessary or could be replaced by oral medication. Worse still, coordinator of WHO's Department of HIV/AIDS, Gunda Oralweiler, warns these injections often are not safe and are driving the spread of deadly infectious diseases worldwide.
We do know that 1.7 million hepatitis B infections are probably attributable to unsafe injections, and more than 300,000 hepatitis C infections every year. So this is a major contribution to the viral hepatitis epidemics. In 2000, there was an estimate that around 10% of new HIV infections were attributable to unsafe injection. Now, for 2010, this has been reduced to less than 1%. Okay. So there is a clear reduction of HIV transmission attributable to unsafe injection, also due to the promotion of safe injection policies.
Despite this progress, Dr. Weiler notes an estimated 33,800 people a year still are contracting HIV through unsafe injections. He says deadly infections are transmitted when a dirty syringe or needle is used on more than one person. Such risks mainly exist in developing countries, but unsafe injections occur all over the world. WHO says the solution for millions of people in rich and poor countries alike is the same. It says millions of people could be protected from infectious diseases by switching to new smart syringes that can be used only once. Several models are available. One causes the plunger to break after the injection. Other models have a metal clip that blocks the plunger from moving back or a needle that retracts into the syringe barrel at the end of the injection. Lisa Hedman in WHO's Department of Essential Medicines and Health Products says WHO is not recommending any particular device because not all injections are the same. She says different devices are needed for different applications.
There are a number of technologies out there, and the reason for that is, in fact, that there isn't really a one-size-fits-all solution, but it's really a broad category of saying, let's bring safety to all of the devices that are out there to make sure that they can't be reused and that they are, you know, fit for the purpose that they were intended.
Previous WHO-led injection safety campaigns between 2000 and 2010 have made considerable progress. They have resulted in a sevenfold decrease in the reuse of injection devices in developing countries. The goal of this new initiative is to get all countries to exclusively use the new smart syringes by 2020, except in a few special circumstances. WHO is calling on manufacturers to beef up production of these devices. Syringes without safety features cost 3 to 4 cents each in developing countries. The new smart syringes cost at least twice that much, but WHO believes the price will go down as demand increases. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Around a third of people living in South Sudan's main towns have access to pipe water. That is what a report released today by USAID-funded project Sustainable Water and Sanitation in Africa, or SWASA, says. South Sudanese authorities hope to significantly close the clean water gap in Juba by 2020. But as Philip Tonaleo reports, that will require a lot of resources.
Of the 1.3 million people living in the 6 main cities in South Sudan, only 438,000 have access to pipe water, according to SWASA. The water is supplied by the South Sudan Urban Water Corporation, or SSUWC, a government body created in 2008. SWASA is helping SSUWC with a 3-year management plan to try to increase the number of people with access to pipe water. USAID's Health Director in South Sudan, Laura Campbell, says SWASA has been providing its partners in South Sudan with data analysis about water access and availability for the first 3.5 years. That has helped to improve water access in town, Campbell says.
They had an existing water system, and SWASA helped build out the network to over 3,000 people in Maridi. In Juba, I think it's more of an example of the institutional reform in the plans that we've made for the government of South Sudan to really take on the sanitation, water and sanitation investment plans for the city.
Campbell says that city council authorities will oversee the implementation of SWASA plan to improve access to clean water. She says USAID earmarked $6.9 million for the capacity building phase of the project. That phase has been ongoing for just over 3.5 years and ends next month. Christopher Swaka is the mayor of Juba. He says the plan for increasing water access that was developed by SWASA will help his office to determine how to reach more households in Juba. He says the current water supply system has to be reconfigured to meet the growing demand for clean water in Juba. He says the capital has to work with SWASA to meet that need.
Let's come and coordinate and put our efforts together so that we can be able to spell out what are our priorities and how best we can be able to go about them. And also, if you look at Juba, for example, you find that Juba has some basic level of water infrastructure. But the way how this water infrastructure was done cannot be able to meet the current urban needs.
Swaka says Juba's water system was built in the 1930s and was intended to channel water into houses using trucks. He says over the years, the system has been expanded to serve several Juba suburbs. The increased service area and an aging delivery system mean city officials cannot guarantee that all residents of Juba have access to clean water, Swaka says. He wants that to change, but there are obstacles to overcome.
So the best way is to ensure that every single household gets water at the tap at home. You can be able to secure the safety of the water that is coming to people. Right now what I'm holding on is a plan of how distribution network of water should be done in Juba. Of course, we as a government, we have plans, but this government is a young government, a lot of priorities. Currently, the country is in crisis. Our resources are so much scattered and spread. Definitely, we have the plans, we have the goodwill, but we need the support.
USAID's Campbell says the authorities in South Sudan, densely populated towns, face enormous challenges as they try to improve access to clean pipe water. She cites the capital as an example.
That Juba City is growing very rapidly, and the government of South Sudan, with the leadership of the mayor who is here today, will need to do some targeted activities both in infrastructure and in capacity development to be able to manage the growing city that Juba has become.
Swaka says trucks still deliver water to most residents of South Sudan cities. But the city authorities have a plan to pipe clean water into 55% of households in the capital by 2020, 70% by 2025, and 85% by 2030. The plan is ambitious and there is a key stumbling block to overcome. In Mayor Soaka's eyes, where will the funding to achieve that goal come from? For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleo in Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, Lucy. An explosion in the northeastern Nigerian town of Potiskum killed at least 10 people today, the second attack to hit the town this week. Witnesses say the blast ripped through a bus preparing to depart from a local bus station. No one has claimed responsibility for the bombing. The town in Yobe State is in a part of Nigeria where government troops are battling the Islamist extremist group Boko Haram. It follows a suicide bombing in Potiskum on Sunday, in which a young girl killed herself and five others. Witnesses describe the girl as being no more than 8 years old. Authorities said at least 19 people were injured in that blast. Greece has presented a list of proposed economic reforms to its European creditors as part of a deal to extend its massive bailout for 4 months. Jerome Dijsselbloem, who heads the group of Eurozone finance ministers, said today that the Greek government's list of reform measures was received on time. A source close to the European Commission said the list of proposed reforms is sufficiently comprehensive to be a valid starting point for a successful review. The source was notably encouraged by the strong commitment to combat tax evasion and corruption. And finally, rebels in war-torn eastern Ukraine say they have begun pulling back heavy weapons from the front lines as required by an internationally brokered ceasefire. Top rebel commander Eduard Basarin said the withdrawal began at 9 o'clock local time today. The move could not be independently confirmed. Ukrainian military officials have not responded, but have insisted that they will not pull weapons off the front lines as long as the fighting continues. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
And that brings us to the end of our show. For this Tuesday, we leave you now with the song Musica La Cocoa by Victoria Ole Aluzai.
We've been listening to Victoria Ole Eluzai with the song Muzika Loka Kwa. I'm Lucy Pony in Washington.
And I'm Michael Atit, also in Washington. We are glad you could join us again for another edition of South Sudan tomorrow from the Voice of America. Woo!